Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who is proud to offer up a literary salute to the presidents in celebration of President's Day, which has just passed. We'll seek out new titles on chief executives, but also on icons who've made their mark in D.C. and the world. And fear not, fiction lovers, we'll also preview some hot new political thrillers. History waits for no man or woman, so let's turn now to page one of the Book Report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. First Hispanic and third woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor is an American icon. Now, in My Beloved World, she intimately recounts her life from a Bronx housing project to the federal bench. From a precarious childhood with an alcoholic father who died when she was nine and a devoted but overburdened mother, Sonia gravitated towards her passionate, spirited paternal grandmother. But when Sonia was diagnosed with juvenile diabetes, she learned ultimately she must depend upon herself. With only TV characters as professional role models, she decided to become a lawyer. To reach her dream, she became the valedictorian of her high school, then on to Princeton, Yale Law School, the New York County District Attorney's Office, private practice, and appointment to the Federal District Court before the age of 40. Along the way, she was shaped by her mentors, a failed marriage, and her very modern version of an extended family. America's infinite possibilities are envisioned anew in this warm and honest book, performed by actress Rita Moreno.
I was barely awake, and my mother was already screaming. I knew Bobby would start yelling in a second. That much was routine. But the substance of their argument was new, and it etched that morning into my memory. "You have to learn how to give it to her, Julie. I can't be here all the time. I'm afraid to hurt her. My hands are trembling." It was true. When my father made his first attempt at giving me the insulin shot the day before, his hands were shaking so much, I was afraid he would miss my arm entirely and stab me in the face. He had to jab hard just to steady his aim. "Whose fault is it your hands tremble?" "Uh-oh, here we go." "You're the nurse, Selena. You know how to do these things." Actually, when Mommy gave me the shot my first morning home from the hospital, she was so nervous that she jabbed me even harder and hurt me even worse than Poppy would the next day. "That's right. I'm the nurse. I have to work and help support this family. I have to do everything. But I can't be here all the time, Julie, and she's going to need this for the rest of her life. So you better figure it out." The needles hurt, but the screaming was worse. It made me feel tired, carrying around the weight of their sadness. It was bad enough when they were fighting about the milk or the housework or the money or the drinking. The last thing I wanted was for them to fight about me. "I swear, Julie, you'll kill that child if you don't learn how to do this." As usual, she walked away and slammed the door behind her, so she had to scream even louder to continue the fight. If my parents couldn't pick up the syringe without panicking, An even darker prospect loomed. My grandmother wouldn't be up to the job either. That would be the end of my weekly sleepovers at her apartment and my only escape from the gloom at home. It then dawned on me. If I needed to have these shots every day for the rest of my life, the only way I'd survive was to do it myself. The first step, I knew, was to sterilize the needle and syringe. Not yet 8 years old, I was barely tall enough to see the top of the stove, and I wasn't sure how to perform the tricky maneuver with match and gas to light the burner. So I dragged a chair the couple of feet from table to stove, the kitchen was tiny, and climbed up to figure it out. The two small pots for Mommy's café con leche were sitting there, getting cold while they fought. The coffee staining its little cloth sack in one pot, la nata forming a wrinkled skin on top of the milk in the other. Sonia, what are you doing? You'll burn the building down, Nena. I'm going to give myself the shot, Mommy. That silenced her for a moment. Do you know how? She looked at me levelly. Seriously. I think so. At the hospital, they had me practice on an orange. My mother showed me how to hold the match while turning the dial, to make the flame whoosh to life in a blue ring. Together, we filled the pot with water, enough to cover the syringe and needle, and some extra in case it boiled down. She directed me to wait for the bubbles, and only then to start counting 5 minutes by the clock. I had learned how to tell time the year before in first grade. After the water had boiled long enough, she said, I would still need to wait for the syringe to cool. I watched the pot, and the invisibly slow creep of the clock's hand until tiny, delicate chains of bubbles rose from the glass syringe and the needle. My mind racing through 100 other things as I marked the time.
We just heard My Beloved World by Sonia Sotomayor. As the patriarch of America's greatest political dynasty, Joe Kennedy was an indomitable figure and elusive man whose dreams of advancement for his 9 children were matched only by his extraordinary personal ambition. Trained as a banker, Kennedy was also a Hollywood mogul, a stock exchange savant, a shipyard manager, the founding chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and an ambassador to London during the Battle of Britain. The book report thinks you will be fascinated by historian David Nassau's The Patriarch, the remarkable life and turbulent times of Joseph P. Kennedy. Drawing on new material from archives on 3 continents, Nassau unearths a man far more complicated than the popular portrait. Was Kennedy an appeaser and an isolationist? An anti-Semite and Nazi sympathizer? A stock swindler, a bootlegger, and a colleague of mobsters? Did he push his second son into politics and then buy the elections? Why did he oppose the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, the Korean War, and American assistance to the French in Vietnam? What was his relationship to J. Edgar Hoover? And how did he influence his son's politics and policies? Malcolm Hilgartner narrates this epic history.
The newly landless, who could afford passage off the island, immigrated. Large numbers of those who remained behind perished. From 1845 through the early 1850s, more than 1 million died, and 2 million more, about one quarter of the population, departed for North America. Mass migrations are made up of individual journeys, and while Patrick Kennedy carried with him many of the same scars as did his compatriots, he differed from them in significant ways. The Kennedys were from County Wexford, on the southeast coast of Ireland, a region well-served, Irish historian David Doyle has written, by banks and trade networks and by schools. Population densities were relatively low, land more fertile, agriculture somewhat diversified, landholdings larger and costlier, and the percentage who emigrated smaller than that from other Irish counties. While in the poorer north and west, small farmers divided their land among their sons, in the southeast the family farms were held intact and passed on from father to oldest son. As the third son and fourth child in his family, Patrick would have no inheritance, and he knew it. The Kennedy leasehold would be passed on to his older brother. Additional resources would go toward a dowry for his older sister and a second leasehold for brother number two. Patrick could, had he chosen, have remained on the family leasehold as a landless laborer. Instead, he left the family farm at Dungenstown and walked the 6.5 kilometers north along the River Barrow to New Ross, the nearby, still-thriving port town, where he found employment at a cooperage. There was a decent living to be made as a cooper, or barrel maker. As the commercialization of Irish agriculture proceeded apace in the 1830s and 1840s, more land had been dedicated to the production of wheat and barley for export off the island or to local breweries and distilleries. Whatever form it took, grain or liquor, the barley and wheat were transported in wooden barrels, which were handcrafted by New Ross coopers. In good times, there had been more than enough work for coopers like Patrick Kennedy, formerly of Dungenstown. But these were not good times. By 1848 or 1849, the effects of blight, famine, and depression had reached into every corner and occupational stratum, undertakers excepted. Patrick Kennedy, already one step removed from the family farm, had little to detain him in Ireland. There are several young Patricks, Pats, and P. Kennedys in the passenger lists of ships arriving in Boston in the late 1840s from Liverpool or New Ross. We cannot be sure which was our Patrick, but we can be certain that whether he left from New Ross or Liverpool, he was 6 weeks on a coffin ship, so called because for so many it would be a final resting place. With little edible food and a minimum of potable water, hundreds of men, women, infants, and the elderly were locked together in darkened, unventilated ship's holds for weeks on end, hatches battened, with no room to stretch, no decent air to breathe, and no escape from the accumulating human waste, the scourge of seasickness, hunger, and thirst, the stench of decay, disease, and dying, and the endless boredom, broken only by fits of panic when storms rocked or fire threatened. Only the strongest survived the passage with body and soul intact. Patrick was one of these. He arrived in East Boston, or Noddle's Island, as it was still known, and remained there for the remainder of his life. East Boston was everything that New Ross was not. The population was growing, jobs and housing were available, and no one, not even the poorest of the poor, starved to death.
We've just heard The Patriarch by David Nassau. William Martin is the award-winning author of 10 novels. His first Peter Fallon novel, 1979's Back Bay, established him as a master storyteller. Four more books in the series have followed, including The Lincolnlander, his new title, and the subject of our talk today. Pulitzer Prize winner and noted Lincoln scholar Doris Kearns Goodwin said about the book, "What an irresistible combination, a sparkling mystery, intriguing characters, and lively history. I am a huge William Martin fan, but The Lincolnlander is my absolute favorite." Martin is known for following the lives of the great and the anonymous in American history and has taken readers from the Pilgrims to 9/11. It's a pleasure to speak with him today. Welcome, William. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
The Lincolnlander is set in the present day and during the Civil War. What was it like to juxtapose the two stories?
Well, I've written several novels like this where we go back and forth in time between similar locations. Washington today is sleek, bright, brilliant, at least the parts of the city that we tend to think about. The Washington of 1862 was dirty, muddy, filthy, filled with backstabbers, rapscallions, thieves, politically ambitious operators of every sort. And in a way, that makes it sound a lot like today.
Yes, it does. The book deals with President Lincoln's private diary as it goes missing. Give us a glimpse into the twists and turns of that storyline.
Well, this is a novel about a diary that Lincoln is writing when he's in the telegraph office, waiting for bad news, which is what he would do most nights. He'd wander over to the telegraph office and sit down. And in the book, he has a diary, and he's leaving his ruminations upon the need for emancipation, the potential consequences of emancipation. And one night he leaves the diary on the desk in the telegraph office, and a young lieutenant picks it up, puts it into his pocket, saying, "I'll get that back to the president tomorrow." That's a bad decision. But in storytelling, bad decisions make great stories. And what we do then is use the diary as a vehicle that carries us through the Civil War. Who gets it? Who wants it? What are they going to try to get out of it? And of course, in the modern story, which just adds resonance to the history, there is a group of characters looking for it today. Where is it today? What would it be worth? It would be invaluable. A Lincoln diary? Imagine. I remember when I was first getting the book off the ground, I chatted with Doris Kearns Goodwin a little bit. We've known each other for years. I said, "How about a Lincoln diary?" And she almost levitated from the chair. Can you imagine what that would be worth? Can you imagine what it would give us as students of history? And then she went on to talk about Lincoln wandering the hallways of the White House at night, unburdening himself to no one. What if he was unburdening himself in a diary?
So there isn't actually any evidence or hint that there might have been an actual diary?
No, there's no actual real diary. Lincoln, we know, wrote little notes to himself on the backs of envelopes and things like that. His valet, William Slade, admitted to burning enormous numbers of things like that throughout the course of Lincoln's presidency. So that's sort of a historical precedent. And then, of course, Lincoln himself kept a scrapbook of his speeches during the 1858 campaign, which you can actually see at the Documents Gallery at the American History Museum at the Smithsonian. And on the front of it, he has written, as if it were a diary, "This volume contains all my thoughts on the matter of slavery." He wrote it in pencil, 1858, and gave it to a campaign supporter.
Wow. Yeah. The Lincoln era scenes are so evocative. How much time did you spend researching those?
Well, I did a lot of reading, as I always do. I start my research a mile wide and an inch deep, reading the generalized texts, and then I start boring holes down into it. I start reading primary sources, Walt Whitman's memoranda during the war. I read the Washington Daily Republican for most of 1865. That was the newspaper. Not just to find out the war news, which isn't particularly well described, but the daily operations of how a city works and how people go about things. Read the ads. I can tell you how much a bowl of she crab soup cost at the Gosling restaurant on Pennsylvania Avenue. And I can also tell you that Miss Laura Keene is appearing at Ford's Theater on the week of April 11th to April 15th. Closes Friday night. Yes, it did. You know, that all comes from the advertising. And in a way, you get this great chill when you read things like that, because you have this great sense of historical dramatic irony as you look back and say, I know what really happened. But my job as a novelist is to take you back to that place before the history becomes history. And you don't know that it's about to become the history.
And you do an amazing job.
Thank you. Thank you.
The political lobbyists portrayed in the present day portion of the book are odious. I'm guessing you knew your share of these folks to write about them accurately.
Well, it isn't so much that I hang out with a lot of lobbyists as it is that I am bothered by the power of lobbies, which means the power of sort of unfettered financial support pouring into these lobbyists. I am bothered by how that affects our political process, how so much of it is driven by the people with the money who hire people for a lot of money, who then have connections with the politicians. And yet, the theme of the book, one of the themes of the book, is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Because Civil War Washington, the lobby of the Willard Hotel, is filled with politicians. It's filled with opportunists. It's filled with people who wander from corner to corner, hiding behind newspapers, listening, hoping that they can pick up a little bit of information or maybe advance their cause. And it's from the lobby of the Willard Hotel that we get the term lobbyist.
I recently watched an interview with author historian David McCullough. When asked, he said Washington was our finest president. Who would you pick and why?
Well, I know that he's always felt that way. I got to know him when I was doing an episode of The American Experience on the life of Washington about 20 years ago on PBS. And he said, you know, Bill, you ought to write a novel about Washington someday. And so I did. And part of the research of writing it was to see what other people said about him. And Lincoln said of Washington, Washington is the star that outshines us all. Lincoln understood the challenges that Washington had to face in establishing a presidency, what it meant, how it would operate, and so forth. In a greater way, George Washington is the keystone of American independence. If you take out any of the others, including John Adams or Thomas Jefferson, out of that arch that stretches from 1775 to, say, 1800, the arch won't collapse. You'll pretty much get the American democracy that you got. But if you take Washington out, it'll all just fall apart because of so many of the things that Washington did, so many of the precedents he established. That being said, I think Lincoln was the greater president because of the inconceivable enormity of what he had to lead this country through.
Have you ever thought about what Reconstruction would have been like had Lincoln not been assassinated?
Yeah, I think so. I think things might have gone a little bit more smoothly. I think that the country might look a little different now. But as I always say, 19th century America would have looked different had Lincoln lived. But imagine how different it would have looked had he never lived. I think we would have by now seen two countries, maybe three or four on this continent. And who knows how they would all interrelate.
Have you seen the new Daniel Day-Lewis Lincoln movie, and what are your thoughts?
You know, I was so impressed by his performance that I don't think that anybody's ever going to be able to think of Abraham Lincoln again without somewhere hearing the sound of Daniel Day-Lewis's voice and seeing him slouching along through the role, because I think physically he really captured Lincoln.
Are you already working on a new project?
Yes, I'm working on several new projects, and when I've decided which one is the best one to pursue and I finish writing it, you'll be the first to know.
Okay.
Anyone who's interested in reading more about my books or learning a little bit more about what I'm up to can visit my website, www.williammartinbooks.com.
Well, readers, I have to tell you, this one, The Lincoln Letter, was a wonderful book, a real page-turner. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Lincoln Letter, narrated by John Pruden.
Peter Fallon received a copy of that letter as an attachment to an email in the third week of September. He would not have read it, except that it came from Diana Wilmington, an assistant professor at the George Washington University and author of a controversial new book, The Racism and Resolve of Abraham Lincoln. The book had gotten her onto television, radio, magazine covers, and made her one of the most recognizable African-American scholars in the country. Peter had also dated her when she was an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts. "I've been thinking of you," she wrote. "I still read the Boston gossip pages. How could I not, after the gossip we inspired? So that bit about you and Evangeline caught my eye. Not getting married, but still having a reception. Genius." Yes, thought Peter. Genius. The hall had been rented, and the champagne was cold. It was a great party. As for the decision not to get married, he was not so sure. He took a sip of wine and kept reading. "I really liked Evangeline. I thought she was good for you." True. Peter couldn't remember which of them first said, "If it works, don't fix it." But now Evangeline was prepping a new project in New York, and Peter was guest curating a new exhibit in Boston. "However," Diana went on, "I'm not writing about your love life. I'd like you to take a look at this attachment." Peter clicked on the scanned image of a letter. He glanced first at the header, printed in an old English typeface, Executive Mansion. Beneath it was the word Washington. the date April 14, 1865, and to the side the word private, handwritten and circled. Then Peter's eye dropped to the signature, to the clear and characteristic cursive that was the holy grail of autograph collectors everywhere, A. Lincoln. In an instant, he knew that whatever this was, it was worth seven figures. A Lincoln signature on a Lincoln letter written from the Lincoln White House. Then he looked again at the date and felt a chill. The day Lincoln was shot. He wiped the sweat from his palms as if he were touching the original instead of seeing it on a computer screen. He almost went looking for white cotton curatorial gloves. Could this be Lincoln's last letter? A last insight into the most analyzed, adulated, biographied, beloved, and in a few places detested man in American history? And what did this anonymous lieutenant have that mattered so much at the end of the Civil War? Peter clicked again on the email. I held this letter in my hands a week ago. A man was offering it for sale to the American Museum of Emancipation. I told him that we were a small museum, hoping to consolidate with the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture when it opens in 2015, but that I would talk to our board. When I tried to contact him 2 days ago, he had gone incommunicado. I'd been planning to ask you to appraise the letter. Would you be willing to put your skills to finding it, or at least uncovering the story behind it? Peter lifted the wine bottle. One more tip of the glass would bring him to the bottom of the label. When he drank alone, something he'd been doing more since the wedding that wasn't, he had a rule. Drink to the bottom of the label and no farther. Stopper the bottle, and every few nights finish the high-quality dregs.
We have just heard The Lincoln Letter by William Martin. In John Meacham's Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author brings an extraordinary man and his remarkable times to life. Jefferson hated confrontation, yet his understanding of power and human nature enabled him to move men and to marshal ideas, to learn from his mistakes, and to prevail. Passionate in every aspect of his life, Jefferson strove to realize his vision, the creation, survival, and success of popular government in America. Drawing on U.S., British, and French archives, as well as unpublished presidential papers, Meacham presents Jefferson as the most successful political leader of the early republic, and perhaps in all of American history. The father of the ideal of individual liberty, of the Louisiana Purchase, the Lewis and Clark Expedition, and of the settling of the West, Jefferson recognized the genius of humanity and that the genius of the new nation lay in the possibility of progress. Edward Herman and John Meacham narrate.
On Thursday, February 1st, 1770, Jefferson was playing his accustomed role as head of the family, accompanying his mother on a visit to a neighbor, when word of disaster reached them. Shadwell had burned. Jefferson was devastated. His first question to the slave who brought the news was whether his library had been rescued from the flames. The books were all burned, the slave replied, adding, "But ah, we saved your fiddle." For a man who prized physical objects, he was to prove an inveterate collector, a tangible manifestation of his curious mind. The ash and the smoke and the ruins were especially galling and dispiriting. Fire was a reminder of those things, those many things, that lay beyond human control. Jefferson had spent almost a decade in the study and the practice of law, an undertaking based on the premise that men could, with some limitations, construct an order that enabled them to exert some power over the affairs of the world. The destruction of Shadwell was an example of how little control Jefferson, or any man, really had. Nearly everything was gone. The burned books amounted to 200 pounds, Jefferson guessed, but that did not bother him so much. Would to God it had been the money. That would have never cost me a sigh, he wrote to John Page. The real pain came from the loss of his books and his legal papers, including notes he had prepared for his work as a lawyer during the coming court term. Without them, he was no longer master of the work at hand. He was desperate, even frantic, dispatching news of the fire and pleas for advice and reassurance. He contemplated moving from the neighborhood altogether, a remarkable thought for a man so engaged by his sense of place. Another measure of Jefferson's grief at the fire is that the loss of his notes evoked a speech of Prospero's in The Tempest, one of the landmark tragic set pieces in Shakespeare, whom Jefferson had first encountered in his father's now charred library. He bleakly alluded to it in the wake of the Shadwell disaster. "Our revels now are ended. These our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." It was a time of testing for the young scholar and aspiring statesman. It was easy enough to read of tragedy and to explore it philosophically, turning over the problems of the spirit and the nature of things with glasses of wine in hand at warm hearths. The ability to apply what one thought in order to shape how one felt, however, was another more difficult thing. Thomas Jefferson had this ability. His head and his heart were contiguous regions of his character with open borders. Plenty of philosophical men live in abstract regions, debating types and shadows. The rarer sort is the reader and thinker who can see the world whole. In the ashes of Shadwell, Jefferson managed to do just that.
That was Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power by John Meacham. Brad Meltzer is the New York Times bestselling author of The Inner Circle and other bestsellers including The Tenth Justice, The First Counsel, The Zero Game, The Book of Lies, and now The Fifth Assassin. He is also the host of Brad Meltzer's Decoded on the History Channel. Brad's best-selling nonfiction books, Heroes for My Son and Heroes for My Daughter, are collections of heroes, from Jim Henson to Rosa Parks, that he's been working on since the day his kids were born. He's also one of the co-creators of the TV show Jack and Bobby, and is the Eisner Award-winning author of the critically acclaimed comic book Justice League of America. Welcome, Brad. So nice to have you with us again on the Book Report.
Always good to be back.
Well, introduce us to Beecher White, the hero of The Fifth Assassin.
Yeah, you know, Beecher is not the best fighter. He's not good with guns. But what he is he's smarter than anyone. And he's smarter than you, and he's smarter than me. So when he sees this dead body and finds this dead body, you know, he's an archivist who works in the National Archives. And he sees this dead body and notices in the door there's a little hole that's drilled into the door. And he says, wait. He remembers, you know, it's odd, because John Wilkes Booth, when he killed Abraham Lincoln, drilled a little peephole through the door to make sure he knew where Lincoln was. And then he notices in the umbrella stand a piece of wood. And he knows that, also, oddly, that John Wilkes Booth used a piece of wood just that size to bar the door when he shot Abraham Lincoln. So while the police see a crime scene, Beecher White sees a recreation of one of the greatest crimes in American history, the death of Abraham Lincoln. And I think that is who he is as a character. He's as nerdy as can be and as smart as can be. And I love that his best weapon is his brain.
So the premise of The Fifth Assassin is this, that, as you say, there have been four presidential assassinations, but Beecher White believes the killers all may be linked.
Yeah, well, what he sees, you know, what the real plot of the book is a serial killer meticulously recreating the crimes of all the presidential assassins from John Wilkes Booth to Lee Harvey Oswald. And you're exactly right. Instead of being four lone wolves, he realizes that they're all working together for the same secret cause over the course of a century. And he's working his way up to be the fifth assassin by working to kill the current president.
So the fifth assassin is the second installment of the Culper Ring trilogy. But what is the Culper Ring?
Yeah, the Culper Ring, you know, George Washington used to have his own secret spy ring back during the Revolutionary War. This is all real. I didn't make this up. And I remember saying, I did some work with Homeland Security, and I said to my friend at Homeland Security, wouldn't it be cool It was made up of just regular, ordinary citizens. And Washington picked regular people because he said no one will look twice at them, so they could pass messages secretly. And I said to my friend in Homeland Security, wouldn't it be cool if you found out George Washington's spy ring still existed to this very day? And he said to me, what makes you think it doesn't? And I said, that's where I got the plot for my book. So I began with The Inner Circle, which was, you know, and you can read The Fifth Assassin on its own. It stands alone. But obviously, you get to see where Beecher goes, and you get to see him take on the serial killer who's recreating these presidential assassin crimes.
Now, something else that you said was true is this Museum of Health and Medicine, and you visited it in researching the book. What kind of collections does it have, and can anyone visit?
Yeah, you know, the reason that the book came about is because, you know, I do this show on the History Channel called Decoded, and we have a lot of fun with that. But as a result of the show, no one gets crazier email than me. No one gets sent more, you know, wacky stories. Someone sent me the Holy Grail, brought me the Holy Grail at a book signing once. But sometimes you get someone who's, you know, really got something amazing. And a friend of mine, who's a longtime reader, said to me, Brad, I work at a museum in Washington, D.C. that almost nobody knows about, and you have to come see our collection here. And I said, well, what do you have? And he said, well, we have the bones of John Wilkes Booth, we have pieces of Abraham Lincoln's skull, and we have the actual bullet that killed Abraham Lincoln. Would you like to come see it? You better believe I wanted to go see it, right? I was like, you got it, I'm there. And when I got there, I saw they didn't just have artifacts from the Lincoln assassination, but they had some from the other assassinations as well. And that's when it just really got me thinking, what if you did have these killers? And the collection is amazing. He opened up a drawer, and you know, I said, what's that? And he says, that's the bones of President Garfield, who was the second president ever killed by an assassin. Then he opened up another drawer and took out a jelly jar that had a spongy material in it. And I said, what's that? And he said, that's the brain of Charles Guiteau, the man who killed President Garfield, the second assassin to successfully kill a president. And any man that hands you a brain, that's the person you want to invite to your party, right? He's going to be fun. But where the book really came from, and to answer your question, yes, anyone can go see the bullet that killed Lincoln. You can go see the pieces of Abraham Lincoln's skull. You can't see these things in the back. They're part of their archives. And some of them, they don't even know where they come from. They're just part of the collection over years and years that people say belong to different assassins. And one of them, one of the assistants, she handed me a piece of leather, like when you buy a new couch, a new sofa, and they give you a swatch of leather to see what color your sofa is. And I said, what's the writing on this? Because I could see some faint writing. She said, oh, that's the tattoo. And I realized what I was holding was not just leather, it was someone's skin. And I said, oh my gosh, this is crazy. But what I saw on that skin was a red diamond. And here's what I love. This is how my brain works. Like you see in a deck of playing cards, a red diamond like that, is I know that when Abraham Lincoln was killed, every detail is known about the moment he was shot. The only detail that's not known is how John Wilkes Booth got past the White House valet. And famously, John Wilkes Booth walked into the front door of Ford's Theater, ran into the White House valet, an employee who worked for the White House. And this is the moment, right? He can change history if he just stops John Wilkes Booth at this moment. And at that moment, John Wilkes Booth hands the White House valet a mysterious card. And to this day, the only detail that is not known about the Lincoln assassination is what is on this card. And some people say that it was his calling card or a business card. And I know back then, business cards used to be used as playing cards, because playing cards were blank on one side. You'd put your name on the other side. And I started thinking, wait a minute. You got a playing card that I can link to Abraham Lincoln's killer. And now I can potentially link a playing card with a red diamond on it to the second killer. What if they all are working together? And here's obviously where the fiction takes over. But now I suddenly have the plot for the book. I have the thread that I can weave through my mystery.
I think Nico is one of the most memorable bad guys in fiction today. How did you think him up?
You know, it's funny. Nico is, people, I love you for saying so. Nico is one of my favorite characters to write. And he's a presidential assassin who did not succeed. And he's in an insane asylum. I mean, he's at St. Elizabeth's, which is where they keep John Hinckley. And Nico, for all his craziness, you know, he talks to the last person who he killed. So he literally talks to a first lady who died books ago. He talks to dead people. But Nico speaks the truth. He almost always speaks the truth. And I think that's why he's such an interesting character. I will say he's the one character that my wife says to me, when I read this character, that's when I feel like I don't know you anymore. And that's when, to me, personally, as a writer, I know that I'm doing, hopefully, a good job. When you start to freak out your own wife.
Yeah, he's one bad dude. Another thing that really impresses me and all your fans is the pace of your writing. How would you tell an aspiring writer to develop that skill?
I wish there was an answer, but I write what I like to read, and I like to have the pace go quickly. I don't want to be bored. I want to be not just entertained, but I want to be on the edge of my seat. And there is no magical secret. It's just a matter of, of making that plot really work and making you, most of all, care about the characters. If you care about the characters, the plot will move. And don't never forget that characters are the best plot.
Yep, page turners. One of your glowing reviews comes from President George H.W. Bush, and he said, Brad, is a real storyteller who keeps us all on the edge of their seats. And he's helped you with some of the research. How did you meet him, and tell us about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I got one of the best fan letters I ever got in my life. And it came from former President Bush. I had gotten a letter from President Clinton years ago when he read one of the books. This one came and just said, President Bush said that he liked my novel, The Millionaires, and could I send him a copy? And I was like, sir, you're the former president, I'll send you a free book. to me, that was obviously very, I felt very lucky to get that letter. And he's helped me research three different books now, and it is pretty amazing to have that. Be able to ask him those questions because those, I can make up whatever I want. These are mysteries and these are thrillers, right? But we all know, Elaine, that there are only a few people on this planet who know what it's like to live in the White House when someone's out there trying to kill them. So I got to go to former President Bush and be able to ask, are you scared of that moment? And his answers and what he told me helped inform my president in the book. And so when you read The Fifth Assassin, you don't just get what I make up, but you get what a real president, it really does inform me. And, I think we all think of what assassins have in common. Our presidents have some things in common, too.
When can we expect to see book three in the Culper trilogy?
It takes me about 2 years because I need to do massive amounts of research. It's always about the research for me. One of the things I found in this book, I got to play with is Camp David. And we've all heard of Camp David, right? The Camp David Accords, and we know those things, but we don't know anything about the place. What actually goes on there? And I found that it's really like a second home for the president, and they can go there, and they can go golfing, and they can go skeet shooting, they can do all these fun things. But the best perk of Camp David is simply this: there's no press allowed. And so they can go there and actually relax. But one of the things that I was happy to find is that there's a secret tunnel that runs below Camp David.
All right. Well, what other projects are you working on right now?
We just announced yesterday, in fact, that we're going to be doing a new children's book series of all things about American heroes. People who know, I write nonfiction, too. I did Heroes for My Son and Heroes for My Daughter, a collection of heroes from Rosa Parks to Jim Henson to Mr. Rogers, of just 50 heroes and their stories for my kids so that they can see who real American heroes are. We're going to now do an illustrated children's book form. So the first one's going to be I'm Amelia Earhart. And then the next book you'll actually see will be a book for Decoded. We're going to do a Decoded book, counting down the top 10 conspiracies throughout history.
Well, Brad, I love this book, and I'm waiting for book number three in the trilogy. Thanks so much for joining us today.
So appreciate it, Elaine. Thanks so much.
Alrighty, bye.
Take care.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Brad Meltzer's The Fifth Assassin, performed by Scott Brick.
Everything was shaking as she stood from her seat and embraced Wallace. Returning her hug, but staying silent, the president slowly made his way to the far end of the front row, pretending he didn't see their 12th grade history teacher in the crowd. But the president's real pain didn't come from spotting old friends. It came from the certain knowledge that he was responsible for all this. True, the president didn't pull the trigger, but it was the president who sent Palmiotti after the archivist, Beecher. It was Beecher who had learned what the president and Palmiotti had done on the worst night of their lives, back in college, 26 years ago. It was Beecher who found out that they had buried a baseball bat and car keys into the face of a man from their hometown, and that Palmiotti and the future president, along with Wallace's sister, had shattered the man's eye socket, punctured his face, and driven bits of his skull into his brain, causing irreversible brain damage. Worst of all, it was Beecher and the group he worked with, who would never let it go, never stop searching, not until they could actually prove what happened that night years ago. Beecher and his so-called culper ring. They were the ones who could do the real damage, the ones who knew Wallace and Palmiotti's secret. Yet that wasn't the only secret the president was keeping. Taking his seat at the end of the far end of the aisle, the president of the United States eyed his best friend's coffin. Almost on cue, his phone vibrated in his pocket. Looking down, President Wallace pulled it out just enough to read the newest text on screen. "How's my funeral going?" Dr. Stuart Palmiotti asked. Part 1. The First Assassination. "What will Miss Harris think of my hanging on to you so?" Mary Lincoln asked, holding her husband's hand. "She won't think anything about it," Abraham Lincoln replied. They were the last words Lincoln spoke before John Wilkes Booth put a bullet in his brain. Chapter 1. Today, Washington, D.C. The night knew his history and his destiny. In fact, no one studied those more carefully than the night. Rolling a butterscotch candy around his tongue, he pulled the trigger at exactly 10:11 p.m. The gun, an antique pistol, let out a puff of blue-gray smoke, sending a spray of meat and blood across the wooden pews of St. John's Church, the historic building that sat directly across the street from the White House.
You shot me, the rector cried, clutching the top of his shoulder, his shattered collarbone, as he reeled backward, then turned to stumble down the main aisle.
The blood wouldn't stop, but the knight's gun hadn't delivered a kill shot. At the last minute, the rector, who'd been in charge of St. John's for nearly a decade, had moved. The knight just stood there, waiting for him to fall. The stark white plaster mask he wore ensured that his victim couldn't get a good look at his face. But the rector still had his strength.
That was The Fifth Assassin by Brad Meltzer. Time Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer David Herbert Donald offers a new classic in Lincoln, a masterly account of how one man's political acumen steered the Union to victory in the Civil War, and of how his soaring rhetoric gave meaning to the agonizing struggle for nationhood and equality. Donald spent 50 years studying Lincoln, tracing his rise from humble origins to the pinnacle of power. He depicts how Lincoln's enormous capacity for growth enabled him, one of the least experienced men ever elected to high office, to become a political giant. Though passive by nature, Lincoln took enormous risks and overcame repeated defeats. More than a political biography, Lincoln shows us a great moral leader, a man who preserved the Union and shaped our country. Dick Estell narrates.
Abraham Lincoln's mother was one of at least eight Nancy Hankses born during the 1780s. Abraham Lincoln believed that his mother was illegitimate. It was a subject that he rarely discussed, but in the early 1850s, while driving his one-horse buggy from Springfield over to Petersburg, Illinois, he found himself talking about it. He and his law partner, William H. Herndon, were about to try a case in Menard County Court that involved a question of hereditary traits, and Lincoln observed that illegitimate children were oft-times sturdier and brighter than those born in lawful wedlock. To prove his point, he mentioned his mother, who he said was the illegitimate daughter of Lucy Hanks, and a well-bred Virginia farmer or planter. From this broad-minded unknown Virginian, Lincoln believed he inherited the traits that distinguished him from the other members of his family: ambition, mental alertness, and the power of analysis. Lincoln may well have been correct in reporting that his mother was born out of wedlock. A grand jury in Mercer County, Kentucky, presented a charge of fornication against his grandmother Lucy, or L-U-C-E-Y, as it is spelled in the old records, and there were several recorded instances of bastardy among Hank's women of her generation. Since no wedding certificate was ever found for Lucy, there was room for endless speculation about Lincoln's maternal grandsire. But Lincoln's remarks, if Herndon accurately reported them after a lapse of many years, were not based on any research into his Hank's ancestry. Instead, they reflected his sense that he was different from the people with whom he grew up. Like other gifted young men, he wondered how he could be the offspring of his ordinary and limited parents. Some, in Lincoln's generation, fancied themselves the sons of the Dauphin, who allegedly fled to America during the French Revolution. Lincoln imagined a noble Virginia ancestor. Of his Lincoln ancestors, he knew only a little more than he did about the Hankses. From his father, he learned that his grandfather Abraham, for whom he was named, had moved from Virginia to Kentucky in the early 1780s. There was a vague family tradition that earlier Lincolns had lived in Pennsylvania, where they had been Quakers, but, as he recorded, the family had long since fallen away from the peculiar habits of that people. Apart from that, William Dean Howells reported in his 1860 campaign biography, there was only incertitude and absolute darkness about Abraham Lincoln's forebears. Further research would have showed that the Lincolns did come from Virginia and that an earlier generation had indeed belonged to the Society of Friends in Pennsylvania. In turn, these could be traced to the original Samuel Lincoln, who emigrated from the county of Norfolk, England, and settled in Hingham, Massachusetts in 1637. A weaver in England, Samuel became a prosperous trader and businessman in America, where he was a pillar of the church and begat 11 children who bore names like Daniel, Thomas, Mordecai, and Sarah, which became traditional in the family. Samuel's grandson Mordecai, 1686 to 1736, was perhaps the most successful member of the family.
That was Lincoln by David Herbert Donald. John Quincy Adams witnessed Bunker Hill, sounded the clarion against slavery on the eve of the Civil War, negotiated an end to the War of 1812, engineered the annexation of Florida, and won the Supreme Court decision that freed the African captives of La Amistad. He served his nation as minister to six countries, secretary of state, senator, congressman, and president. In John Quincy Adams, award-winning author Harlow Giles Unger reveals the man as a towering figure in the nation's formative years and one of our most courageous leaders. Johnny Heller narrates.
"Mr. Adams," the old lady shrieked, "you're embarking under very threatening signs. The heavens frown, the clouds roll, the winds howl, the waves of the sea roar upon the beach." 10-year-old John Quincy Adams looked up at his father, who nodded to the lady, smiled and excused himself, then whispered reassurances in his son's ear. The woman was a good lady, and Adams with very delicate health, much afflicted with hysterical complaints, often a little disarranged in her imagination. With that, father, son, and their servant boarded the barge and bounded over the angry waters toward the 24-gun frigate Boston that waited in the bay to take them across the Atlantic to France. All but echoing the lady's warning, the waves lapped the sides of the barge, slapping passenger faces, stinging John Quincy's eyes with salty spray, and filling him with fear of impending disaster at sea. Several days later, the captain of the Boston confirmed the boy's fear, shouting to crewmen and pointing to the horizon. Three British Navy frigates had climbed into view. Heeling over with sails full, the Boston fled and lost sight of two ships. But the third stayed in sight, pursuing the entire day, night, and all the next day, intent on capturing the American ship and its famous passenger. "Our powder, cartridges, and balls were placed by the guns," John Adams recalled, "and everything made ready to begin the action. As night fell, the enemy was gaining on us very fast. John Quincy knew that if the British captured them, his father faced summary hanging from the yardarm, while the boy himself faced impressment in a life of servitude in the British Navy. Nightfall only added to their danger as winds picked up and swelled into a hurricane. The Adamses went below to their cabin, where it was, with the utmost difficulty, that my little son and I could hold ourselves in bed with both our hands, bracing ourselves with our feet. Then a sudden and tremendous report rocked the ship. Adams and his boy had no way of knowing whether the British frigate had overtaken us and fired on us, or whether our guns had been discharged.
That was a sampling of John Quincy Adams by Harlow Giles Unger. At once an incredible adventure narrative and a penetrating biographical portrait, The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey by Candace Millard, is the true story of T.R.'s harrowing exploration of one of the most dangerous rivers on Earth. After his humiliating election defeat in 1912, Roosevelt set his sights on the most punishing physical challenge he could find, the first descent of an unmapped, rapid-choked tributary of the Amazon. Together with son Kermit and Brazil's famed explorer, Candido Mariano da Silva Rondon, Roosevelt accomplished a feat so great, many at the time refused to believe it. Along the way, Roosevelt and his men faced unbelievable hardships, losing their canoes and supplies to whitewater rapids, enduring starvation, Indian attack, disease, even a murder within their own ranks. Three men died, and Roosevelt was brought to the brink of suicide. The River of Doubt brings alive these extraordinary events in a powerful nonfiction thriller. Paul Michael narrates.
For Roosevelt's men, fears for their own survival were eclipsed only by despair about the fate of their leader. As Roosevelt's fever soared to 105 degrees, Cherry and Kermit, Roosevelt's second son, were certain that they were witnessing his final hours. "The scene is vivid before me," Kermit would later recall. "The black rushing river with the great trees towering high above along the bank. The sodden earth underfoot. For a few moments, the stars would be shining. And then the sky would cloud over and the rain would fall in torrents, shutting out the sky and trees and river." As the fever-racked former president drifted in and out of consciousness, he slipped into a trance-like delirium, reciting over and over again the opening lines to Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Kubla Khan. "In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. In Xanadu..." Part 1. Breaking Away. Chapter 1. Defeat. The line outside Madison Square Garden started to form at 5:30 p.m., just as an orange autumn sun was setting in New York City on Halloween Eve, 1912. The doors were not scheduled to open for another hour and a half, but the excitement surrounding the Progressive Party's last major rally of the presidential campaign promised a packed house. The party was still in its infancy, fighting for a foothold in its first national election. But it had something that the Democrats had never had, and the Republicans had lately lost. The star attraction that drew tens of thousands of people to the garden that night. Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt, one of the most popular presidents in his nation's history, had vowed never to run again after winning his second term in the White House in 1904. But now, just 8 years later, he was not only running for a third term, he was, to the horror and outrage of his old Republican backers, running as a third-party candidate against Democrats and Republicans alike.
We've just heard River of Doubt by Candace Millard. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this reflection on the men and women who have shaped our country. For more top titles on politics, history, and biography, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.